new book, Breaking Free from Critical Addiction. Of course, none of us are critical. We have trouble relating to that. Don't forget that she's going to hold a book signing immediately after the celebration. Kaylee?
Thank you.
Wow, I can't tell you how wonderful it is to see all these beautiful faces again. It's really nice to be here. So I do thank you for the invitation. Breaking free from critical addiction. You know, I've talked about writing a book for years. Those who know me, the eternal book. Wait, can you hear a word?
Can that come down so that...
There, is that better? Yeah, okay. You can see my face now, okay. I talked about writing a book for years, the eternal book. I wanted it to be one of those lovey, oh, like the one you read from. That's what I wanted my book to be. But my name is Kali. It's Kaylee. It's the loving expression of Kali, the goddess of destruction, and she destroys everything that separates you from God. That's my job.
That's interesting.
That's my job. Peace, love, joy, happiness, that is what my life is about. But there's all these blocks in the way. You know, I just think I've got it all together, you know, and then, oh wow, what happens? Have any of you had that experience? And I was raised in a very critical family. I can still hear my mother. When I was playing the piano, when I'd hit the wrong key, I can hear her calling from the far end of the house, it's A sharp, not A natural, before I could even correct it myself. Criticism is a way of life. Well, after all, if you're a good parent, you have to tell your children what's wrong with them. Straighten them out. I mean, that's what we're told, the teachers. They're supposed to tell you what's wrong with you. Oh, and when I first became a psychotherapist, and we'd go to public functions and social functions, and people would say, oh, and what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a psychotherapist. And they'd go, it's really nice meeting you. Because their idea of a therapist was, that I look at people and I analyze them and I see what's wrong with them. Because our society values critics. Our society values criticism. We pay our critics a fortune. Right? Snob appeal. Find fault with other people. Tell them just exactly what's wrong with them. Our society functions with criticism, and we think that if we make our children feel guilty, they won't do it again. And our prisons are full of people who feel guilty. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. But we don't challenge this assumption. We don't challenge this idea that runs our whole society, not all cultures, but ours, I know, and many others. It kind of goes along with capitalism, frankly. Competitive society. Now, there's nothing wrong with building a better mousetrap. That's wonderful. But what if you don't have a better mousetrap? Then you better get busy running down your competition's mousetrap. Unfortunately, that's what happens in politics. If you can't offer what people want, make them afraid of what your opponent wants. It has become a way of life here. We go to movies that are negative. We look at future doom and gloom. Good news doesn't sell. We are addicted to to negativity, let's face it, and fault finding. When we go to be with groups, we often bond with each other through criticism. Girls get together and bash the men. Men get together and bash the women. It's a bonding ritual. And of course, we could talk about those fundamentalist Christians and bond. It's sad. It's really sad, but we haven't really looked at it as a problem. We have looked at it as a solution. We've said, well, what you've got to do, this is how you problem solve. I wrote my book, and my brother read it. He's a psychologist. And he said, Caleb, this is a very interesting do-it-yourself book. But he said, you didn't talk about the positive benefits of a critical mind. And I said, no, I didn't. He didn't get it. I watched this happen, and it really is a social disease. Because we catch it from each other. We get it often from our mother's milk. We pass it on to our children. We go into the workplace, we catch it from each other at work. We pass it on. We go to school, the kids go to school, they catch it, they pass it on, we have bullying, and we wonder why we have bullying. Oh, shame on these kids who are bullying, as the parent berates them. Criticism is bullying. Oh yes, you know, I was thinking of a quote I wanted to write, read, and I said, well, I'll write it down. And I thought, no, I can quote, it's my book. Let's see here, where was it? It's It's a bad. Oh yeah. Criticism is a guilty pleasure that once indulged attracts the user again and again, like an addict to a drug. Whenever the critic feels down or has problems, he or she uses criticism like a drug to feel better. It gives the user a false sense of superiority or power over others, even though that power is purely destructive to others and themselves. Not only are they attracted to being critical of others to feel better, but because critical energy is negative, they attract criticism to themselves as well. This perpetuates a vicious, self-destructive cycle as they become the target of criticism from others, lowering their self-esteem and causing them to become even more critical. Although criticism is not a substance, it is as addictive as any drug. And I propose that it is a threat that is actually more insidious. Habitual criticism, or fault-finding, has all the characteristics of a drug. It's habit-forming, mood-altering, right? Life-threatening, it can be life-threatening. Distorts awareness, leads to destructive behavior, and adversely affects mental and physical health. But it's more insidious. It's more insidious because, first of all, there's no product involved. It's free to everybody. Anyone can have it, rich or poor alike. It's masked by social popularity, as we've talked about. Society values criticism. It is mistaken for problem solving. It's a communicable social disease. It's used for social control. And it's the basis of all other addictions. For years, I have been connected to the addiction, the 12-step community and people working on their addictions. And I remember the first time a young man came to me and he said, Kaylee, I don't understand. I worked on my addiction. I got over my alcoholism. I've been clean for quite a while, and now I find out I have love addiction, and I thought I'd gotten over that, and then I found out I have an eating addiction, and I just keep going from one addiction group to another. Isn't there an end to this? And I heard that again this week from a dear friend, been clean for a long time, and is discovering new addictions cropping up. The new addictions crop up because we create an inner critic. And that's what isn't challenged. Now, I want to talk about where criticism comes from and the effect of it. When we're born, we come into this world a blank slate. And the deepest yearning, talk about yearning, that infant wants to know self. Know what it is. And it looks out for feedback from the world to tell it. Just like you or I, we go to the mirror, we want to know what we look like, we look in the mirror, we get feedback. The child looks out, and someone looks down and coos, and it goes, "Ooh, I'm an ooh. Oh, I'm a little shit. Oh." And each one of the feedbacks come in like some paper mache that starts molding the image of self. So after a while, there's this false image of self that's based on everybody else's opinion, regardless how distorted their perception is. And the concept of self is totally false. Totally false. Now, to further complicate this, I just learned, I had a client. She had been sexually molested by her father, who was a heroin addict, for years. We got over the post-traumatic stress. That was easy. What wasn't easy was she found that when she was talking with her child and working with her child, she was being mean to her child, just like her father. She's, "Kaylee, what can I do? It just comes out." And that's when I began searching, what is going on here? And discovering that the molester, her perpetrator, lived inside of her. How does it get there? Really simple. We have something organically in our body called mirror neurons. Mirror neurons are very useful, but they can also get a virus in them. See, bear in mind, as I'm talking about all these things coming in, this is programming, right? This is all programming. Every message that comes in is a program that gets stuck in here. I have a computer, and in my computer, I have a program called Word. Word is not my computer. I can delete it. It's just a program. It's a very intelligent program. It's a very useful program. Ever had a virus in it? Not useful anymore. Viruses get in programs. We have some programs that are for viruses in us. We have programs. And these programs come in. The mirror neurons, they're very social oriented. In fact, wait a minute, I really want to read some about that because that's not my expertise. Our brains house multiple mirror neuron systems that have a social function. Mirror neurons copy what they see. They carry out and understand not only the actions of others, but also others' intentions. as well as social meaning of others' behaviors and emotions. Mirror neurons make templates for strings of actions linked to intentions. These templates predict what comes next based on past actions observed, thus passing on social and cultural attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors. Empathy and social emotions like guilt, shame, pride, embarrassment, disgust, and lust are based on these mirror neuron systems. Mirror neuron systems help us learn by watching others. It's really handy. I mean, it taught me how to drive, you know? There are very handy programs. I can drive an automatic. You ever been gone down a hill and you said, oh my God, oh, did I pass my stop? Because we drive on automatic. These mirror neurons are great. You know, people, that's how some of these little children in Japan learn how to play the violin. The first time they pick it up, they play perfectly. Why? Because they were taught in their mind to play it perfectly. They never made a mistake. So they had no past mistakes, just success. They play perfectly. People learn how to ski that way. People, I remember hearing about a woman who was very, very ill and she couldn't get up and walk. She had a Tai Chi master come in every day and she watched him and she imagined that she was doing them. And one day she got up and did them. Mirror neurons are very, very powerful and very, very useful. But look at some of the things they observe. They observe how our parents got us to behave. Do we use that to get other people to do what we want? They observe movies, films. They observe all kinds of things, and it puts viruses in our programming. So what happens is the mirror neurons become that inner messenger that says, hey, I want to keep you safe. So, hey, do this, do that. Oh, be afraid of this, be afraid of that. Gives warning. Oh, well, this has to be too good to be true. I feel too good, so something bad's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You ever hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, those mirror neurons are busy, based on the past, giving us warnings, giving us signals of what to be careful for. Those mirror neurons produce what I call the inner critic. The inner critic is the viruses in our programs. Here's the thing that's important. We're not our programs. My computer is not Word. It can exist totally without it. We do have to know what we want. We do have to put some programs in that work. We are responsible for which programs we put in there. But we are not our programs. Now, here's an error that I see happening a lot. And that is that we go, well, that's my wounded child. That's not a wounded child, it's a virus. Or we go, oh, I don't know what made me do it. Oh, I'm just bad, you know. I don't know, I've tried and I'm just hopeless. I keep making these horrible, it's all my fault. No, it isn't. You've got some viruses. You're not your behavior. We hear this all the time. Oh, you're not your behavior. Those are words. But we don't believe them. When we have problems, when we make mistakes, we act like we're the one that did it. We got some faulty wiring. We hear a voice says, bottom line, it says, you're not good enough. Anyone here ever not feel good enough? Wow, surprise! I want to see the one who's never felt that way. I'll become your student. This is the bottom line. The inner critic has a vested interest. It's an intelligent program. It has a vested interest in you letting it be in charge and tell you who you are, what you can do, and what you can't do.
Yeah?
You've already started challenging it. Now, that's the whole thing. If we don't buy it, we can't be controlled by it. Now, one of the things I used to notice that used to piss me off about Course in Miracles is they used to talk about the ego like it was some devil or demon in there or something, and man, I was into loving my ego and so on and so forth, and it was just that part of me that hadn't found love yet and so on. But the Course really doesn't say that. You know, it really doesn't, and I just really mystified for a long time. I didn't get it. The Course is trying to get us to see that's not you. The ego is not you. There's two of you. There's the one that got made up with paper mache, and there's the real you, the authentic real you. And you know those moments when you're on? You know? We've had those moments where it's like, wow, I got so much to offer, so much to give. I'm in the zone. It's like a runner's high. It feels great. That's you. That's the real you. You know, when you don't feel like that, that's not you. That's not you. And the problem is, this inner critic, many people hear and assume it's their guidance. I have to have my fear. It keeps me safe. Wow, I heard that a lot. I've heard that so much. We buy it. There's these assumptions about the nature of reality that we buy as truth. By the way, all of you have had those moments, I call them light bulb moments, you know, when the light bulb goes on and you go, oh, I get it. Yeah. How'd it feel? Yeah, how'd it feel?
Good.
It feels good, right. And I can ask a million people, I get the same response. It feels great. That's you, that's truth. That's what truth feels like. See, we all have inner radar on that. We have a truth mirror. We know what truth feels like. It feels good. And anytime we make an assumption that doesn't feel good, not true. Some distortion is there. Some kind of distortion is present in that assumption. That assumption may be based on fact. My son was murdered. My son was murdered. But what about the assumptions that follow? Oh, it's something terrible is going to happen. Oh, I don't know. We can make up a whole bunch of stuff. You know, I won't be able to live without him. I'll always be sad. It's the worst thing that could possibly happen. Those are all assumptions. They don't feel good. I could never forgive that. That's an assumption.
It was my fault.
It was my fault? Yeah. Hey, it's unforgivable. And you know what? Doesn't feel good. Does that feel good to you? Doesn't feel good to me. So there's some distortion. There's some distortion occurring in there. free from the inner critic. The first step is you've got to recognize that critic. You've got to own it. You have to take over. The authentic, real you has to say, hey, no, I'm standing in this place of center and peace, or else. And I'm going to discern what doesn't work. If I don't like the way I feel, then the problem is in my mind. It's not out there in the world. It's not what happened to my son. If I don't like the way I feel, it's how I'm seeing it. It's what I'm assuming about it. It's the way I'm dealing with it. It's beginning to recognize those negative statements and going, thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing. You see, what most people do is they run away from the inner critic. They do everything to avoid it because we don't identify it. We don't recognize that it's there. We think that everything's happening is us. Oh yeah, that's me. It's my wounded self. It's my dysfunction. I'm dysfunctional. I'm bad. I'm whatever. Here's some of the symptoms of critical addiction. Perfectionism. I'll solve it. I'll do everything perfectly. Then I'll never get criticized. Right? Wow, this is a great one. You ever do everything perfectly? Doesn't work. But perfectionists are trying to, and that's a way to escape from the inner critic, they think. Another one is self-righteousness, prejudice, bigotry. Huh, they're not as good as me. They're worse than I am. That's one way to escape. Sarcasm. Huh. Well, I won't let anybody see my vulnerable feelings. I don't want them to think they mean something to me. I'll just, and if I'm angry, I don't want to get rejected, so I'll just make some joke. Man, growing up, I kept hearing, oh, you're just too sensitive. I was just kidding. You ever hear that? Oh, I was just kidding. Man, I heard some pretty awful things in the name of I'm just kidding. And I'm too sensitive. I like me, thanks. I'm just sensitive enough, and I'm really glad that I'm sensitive. I'm glad that I'm aware. And that's what sensitivity is. It's awareness. It's like, whoa, that didn't feel good. I could feel the attack underneath that. Worry. Oh, good mothers worry. Didn't you know that? If you're a really good mother, you're always worrying about your child. Oh, you know, there's just this world is so scary, and just about anything could happen. So I'll just put all that criticalness inside of me out there on my children. And it's all about them. And I'm going to worry about them. Excuse me. I need some water.
Ooh, dry mouth.
Can you put your chin over there for me?
No, it's okay. I'm okay.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, worry. I was taught that that's what good mothers do. Just think about it. Worrying means, let's see, you don't have faith in your children. You are now creating in your mind negative scenarios. Wow, what are you manifesting? What am I manifesting when I'm worrying and expecting the worst from my children? Them. Not very empowering. It's that whole negative concept. It was like, as a psychotherapist, I would tell somebody I was a psychotherapist and they would expect the worst. On my website, ever since I began in private practice in 83, it has talked about the fact that you don't need one more person telling you what's wrong with you. That's the reason you come for therapy. My job is to help you find out what's right with you and empower you to use it. Another way people run away from the inner critic is with denial and secrecy. My family was based on that. It just didn't happen. My father tried to kill me. Nobody ever mentioned it again. It never happened. Gee, I bring it up to my psychologist brother, when he's in his 30s, and he said, oh, that didn't happen. Don. And it's always, you made too big a deal out of it. Don, did you ever slug our father on any other occasion? No. Oh, maybe it was a big deal. Denial. Secrecy and denial. It becomes such a habit pattern, we don't even realize we're doing it. My brother is one of the most wonderful, insightful, loving people I know. He just hadn't given it any thought because he was raised in that habit pattern. Anger. Wow, if it feels too bad inside, blame other people. Let's get mad. It's the government. It's this. It's that. Put that energy out there because it feels stronger than those vulnerable feelings. It feels better to be mad at somebody else than at myself. I'm helpless to do anything about this, so I gotta blame somebody else. You know, if I can just keep my energy out there, it feels better. It does. The energy's higher than depression. Beats depression any time. But it also is very hard on the body. It's hard on the soul. It's hard on everything about us. Anger in itself is it's a mask. When people are angry, they're really afraid. If you stop and ask yourself, what am I afraid of? You'll actually get to the vulnerable feelings that are creating the anger. And deal with that fear. Is the fear reasonable? No. It's another thing I challenge in my book. There's no such thing as healthy fear. Fear is not healthy. Adrenaline is a natural process in our body. You get adrenaline rush, that's body. Fear, no. We create that in our mind. We imagine a horrible scenario in the future. That's fear. It's totally future-oriented. Disease. Hey, we don't deal with the inner critic long enough, you get sick. It's the underlying cause of disease. And if you just want to stuff your feelings and not feel at all, it's called depression. Depression is when I don't want to feel what I feel. Now, go to substance abuse, that's another thing. I'll go drink some alcohol, have a hit of this or that, then I won't feel. Prescription drugs, hey, I'll do it legally. The bottom line is, resistance doesn't work. Resistance doesn't work. There has to be another way. I remember back in 1966, I discovered my inner critic. I didn't actually discover my inner critic. I discovered that I was critical, right? I was owning it. I was responsible. Something's wrong with me. I'm critical. Hear the difference between that and, wow, I got a critic in me. There's a difference. The first step is to begin to witness that critic as not self. Then you can challenge it. If you don't recognize it, you can't challenge it. There's just instead of just man, there's that man. This doesn't feel good. I discovered I was critical, and I was being very critical of my husband. And I realized one day, oh, wait a minute, everything I'm critical of him of, I'm critical of man. I don't like this. This doesn't feel good. I don't want to do this anymore. So I made a vow that I was never going to criticize again. That's it. I'm going to stop being critical. And I worked very hard not to be critical. And the harder I tried, the more critical I became. Until I got panicked. It's like, oh my God, I can't stop this. It's going crazy. I'm critical of everything. Now I was aware of my criticalness. Before, I just did it. Now I'm being critical of myself for doing it, so I have a double criticism going. My friend said to me one day, Kaylee, if you don't want to be critical, what do you want to be? Wow, I never thought about that. I said, well, I just want to be loving and accepting. And he said, great. He said, you wouldn't want that if you weren't. So as of this day, just go about your life as a loving and accepting person. Do and think and say what loving and accepting people would do. Which changed my life. Which changed my life. Didn't end it by any line, but it was a great new beginning. Resistance does not work. Now, when I did my master's degree in college, I wanted to know how real transformative change happens. They told us as social workers that we were change agents. And I said, well, this is so exciting. And this means that we know the technical aspect and the mechanics of change. And I said, great, what's change? And no one could answer me. They didn't have a clue. So I did my master's thesis on a heuristic view of change, integrating time, consciousness, and energy. Because I had new quantum physics. It was not the typical master's thesis, I want you to know. When I was doing my boards and they sat there to talk to me, the head of the research department said, well, this is a beautiful thesis, but you can't call this a social work thesis. And my mentor, who happened to be the head of the college, said, well, you will or you won't get paid. I discovered some very exciting things. And in that, and by the way, heuristic view is a questioning view. I didn't know the word before that. It's a questioning view. Because I didn't have the answer. Now that's what real research is. Research, if you're really researching, you don't know the answer. You're looking for it. Research, normally they call it research. It's not research, they're wanting to prove something. Very different. I really didn't know. A Course in Miracles was like my Bible in helping me find my way. But here's the thing I discovered. I looked at how transformative change was made out in the world. And the big points in transformation over historically. And how did they happen? And what I discovered was they happened when we challenged the assumptions about the nature of reality. Now, the nature of reality, there's been a taboo against questioning the nature of reality in every society. Any of you raised Catholic? You ever questioned God? Not allowed. Certain things you just don't ask, right? There are certain things you just don't question. I took geometry. I question an axiom. Axioms are self-evident proofs, truths. That's the nature of reality. That's just the way it is. So the teacher and I had some debates over that. habit to question the nature of reality. Now, once upon a time, we believed that the world was flat. Now, based on that assumption was an entire way of life. Based on that assumption, well, of course, if you went to the edge, you'd fall off. We all know about that. The dragons, you know. If you go too high, you'll burn up. The stars are perfect. That's where heaven is. It wouldn't be such a thing as a crater on the moon because it's perfect. And, of course, that means that we have all the land that can ever be had. So there's no room for improvement here. And all knowledge is already known. The Pope has it all. You cobblers and tailors don't need to bother to get an education because the people who need to do that already are spoken for. It's passed down through generations. So schools weren't important. You just did what your parents did. Knowledge was limited. Everything was limited. Then somebody challenged the assumption. Now, Galileo was one of those who challenged it. He happened to be best friends with the Pope, and so instead of being killed for a heretic, like many of them were, he was put under house arrest for the rest of his life. He saw craters on the moon, and then it wasn't perfect. Heresy. There were certain things you just didn't question. Now, as more and more people begin to question this assumption, people begin to challenge it, get in those ships, go out, find other lands. I mean, after all, I mean, Columbus was looking for India. And finally, the assumption began to crumble. You see, truth is not going away. But if it isn't true, the assumption is going to begin to crumble. It's always safe to challenge your assumptions. If it's true, it's not going anywhere. And when it crumbled, the Industrial Revolution was born. Suddenly, there was land enough for everyone. Oh my gosh, all knowledge is known. Education, I don't have to be a cobbler. I can be anything I want. There's a whole world out there. There's a sky to explore. There's land to explore. All the limits went away from one little assumption being challenged. Now, everyone here is working on self-development, and we're challenging our beliefs one at a time. And we're getting rid of our beliefs one at a time. It's not fast enough. It's not fast enough. And some of those beliefs, you'll never get rid of them. You know why? Because the assumption it's based on is faulty. My book challenges the underlying assumptions of our society. We have to challenge the underlying assumptions if we want real change, transformative change. Each one of us has our own nature of reality, what we think we are, and our limits. Each one of us has dragons we're afraid of. We might fall off the edge if we go beyond that limit. The first thing I'm challenging there is the assumption that criticism has any value whatsoever. That's a huge challenge, by the way, since our society is based on it. I'll meet with a lot of resistance from people like my brother who value critical thinking. But fault-finding has been proven to destroy relationships. Destroys lower self-esteem, destroys relationships, inhibits learning, reduces productivity, makes enemies, is a form of bullying, can lead to road rage and violence of all kinds. Guns don't kill people, as we all know. Okay. It's the critical addiction underneath it. As people run away from that inner critic, as people run away from being criticized by others, violence begins to escalate. So I invite all of you to notice that voice or that feeling that says you're not good enough, you're less than, and begin to work with it. Now, it's not fair not to give you the steps, too. They're in my book. I do hope you read it. But also, firsthand talking about things helps. In 2 weeks, on Friday the 15th, I'm going to give a seminar right here. If you're interested, I have flyers on it. And on critical addiction, and we'll talk about the four steps. You see, the other thing I discovered is that there's four things that have to happen to break through from any critical pattern. The first step is the hardest. The second step can't happen until you've really accomplished the first one. The third step can't happen until you do the second. And the fourth one can't happen until you've done all three. That's not my steps. That's just the nature of reality that I found. This is what I observed. And that's what we'll be talking about. I hope you'll come, because you're all people I love. Oh, I got to tell you one thing from my book. I'll try to get my 5 minutes here. As I was writing this book, one of the steps in here has to do with flip it, where you flip and turn things around, really turn them around. And I thought it was all through with that section, and I said, but Kaylee, what if the unthinkable happens? When I have an unthinkable. Unthinkable to me is losing a child. Now, when somebody has any emotion, I go and I feel it with them, and I want to walk in their shoes, and I'm very empathic. I'm very sensitive to energy. So, in fact, when I was a little kid, I was 7, I would go downtown, and I would stand on the street corner, and as people would go by, I would jump into their bodies and feel what it felt like to be them. I love to know, to see the world, and to understand people from inside of them. But there was one thing I won't do, and that's when somebody loses a child, I won't even imagine. It's unthinkable. So the day before, I was getting ready to publish this. By the way, I went back, and I put that in the book. And the day before I was getting ready to publish this, my son was murdered. The unthinkable happened. We took this in. Not only did he die, but he was murdered with his hands behind his back, handcuffed, at the hands of the police who were supposed to be escorting him to Norristown for treatment. They felt threatened. The 250-some pound officer felt threatened. 6'5", 4", felt threatened by my 5'7", 150-pound son. Handcuffed. That's all the justification an officer needs to shoot you. We have discovered that. So be careful what you do. Be very careful. I had trouble putting this to press. What am I going to do? So I held off, waited and waited. Finally, after 7 weeks of the DA having no conclusion, I went to press. And I wrote an afterword in here. Now, right after this happened, my husband, it's his son, it's my stepson. He was hurt very deeply. And he went off to a Buddhist retreat. Now, the first day, I couldn't get him out of the house. Second day, I finally got him to go. Third day, I'm thinking everything's well. I talked to a friend of mine who, when I told her I was writing a book, she said, okay, we make it short. And I had talked to her a few days before, and I had told her that, would she just read my little PDF of the book? Just read this one little section. I think it might interest you. And she had. And she called me back, and she said, okay, it's wonderful. And she said, it works. And she had a miracle over a difficult situation in her life as a result of reading those pages. It worked, she said. So the third day, that same day, my husband called up and he said, I want to come home. He said, I want to kill somebody. He said, they took my son from me. And I said, honey, so-and-so called, and I told him what they said. And he said, well, maybe I should read those pages. Now, by the way, he hadn't read my book yet. You understand? The hardest part is getting people to read it. Anyway, he hadn't read it, so he did read it, and he went right to that part. And he emailed me and said, Kaylee, it works. I'm okay. My book also contains the forgiveness story of a mother whose child was murdered. I didn't know I was writing the book for me and my family. So I hope that it can bring you peace. And somewhere along the line, I hope you can join me, because I do know that applying these steps has kept my family together. And after it happened, we were amazed at the strength God has given us to deal with this with forgiveness. Anything is forgivable.